Welcome to a special edition of MSCI Perspectives. I'm your host, Adam Bass, and today is May 8th, 2025. No one can ignore the fact that private assets have grown to play a much larger role in investors' asset allocation plans. However, there are many investors who still don't fully appreciate how to analyze and integrate these assets into their portfolios. Fortunately, with us today, we have MSCI's Head of Private Assets, Luke Flemmer. Luke, welcome to the program.
Thank you, great to be here.
So let's start off by talking a little bit about your professional journey. How did you get here and right back down to what interested you about this position at MSCI?
Sure. Well, I've been at MSCI for about 6 months, very new in the seat and very, very pleased to be here. I joined from Goldman Sachs Asset Management, where I was running digital strategy for the alternatives complex, so really focused on digitization and data across all flavors of alternatives at Goldman. And prior to that, I spent almost 20 years as a co-founder and CEO of a business called Lab 49, which was a technology, strategy, and consulting business that built a lot of the large platforms, digital platforms for banks, brokers, asset managers, et cetera. So various flavors of sort of digital transformation, use of data, use of technology to enable trading and investing has been sort of the theme of my career. Prior to that, I actually worked, fun fact, I guess, in robotics and automation. So the first 5 or 6 years of my career, I was really looking at how to automate physical processes in the world, and then went on to spend the next 25 or so working on automating, more virtual processes through finance and automation. But I had the sort of privilege of starting working in finance in the early 2000s in fixed income, and really being part of that journey of digitization that we went on in the fixed income markets in the 2000s. So when I started on Wall Street, people were still very much doing doing deals on the phone and sort of doing very manual processes to get deals done in fixed income. And by the time, fast forward 10 years, that was all ultra low latency, electronically traded, et cetera. So really had a ringside seat on a pretty dramatic transformation within financial markets. And that gave me, I think, a lot of the perspective that I bring now to the private markets, which is, we've seen some of these movies before. We've seen the way in which data, algorithms, automation can really facilitate a market, bring much increased liquidity, more participants to that market. And I think that's very much the journey that we're on with private markets. So I was super excited to come to MSCI, obviously a phenomenal and storied brand, but in this role running private assets and really driving the transformation of this industry from within a data and technology powerhouse like MSCI is just a really unique experience.
That sounds fascinating. Very briefly, if you had to sum up the state of the private markets right now, what would that sound like?
Sure. I think we're at a fascinating point in the private markets, and without digging too much into what's going on right now in the markets, which I think has very much has its own dynamics, and maybe we can talk about that a little later because I think it's pretty interesting. But zooming out a little bit and ignoring the last several months of sort of market volatility, I think we're in a really interesting place in private markets where we have, in my view, a little bit of an imbalance in the market. So we have an asset class which is growing, pretty rapidly. We see sustained interest. We see sustained flows into the asset class. But it's also an asset class that doesn't, in my view, yet have the tools, analytics, and data appropriate to support the level of investment that it currently enjoys. So I think we're dealing with, in some sense, a sort of a teenager asset class, right? It's sort of grown up in some ways and maybe not fully grown up in others. And I think certainly part of the journey that we're on at MSCI is how do we bring a level of transparency and rigor to this market?
And does that assessment apply equally across the world? Are we all in our teenage years when it comes to private assets, or is there variation?
I would say that there's variation both globally and by specific asset class as well. So I think that there are asset classes which are intrinsically less liquid and more opaque by their nature, I would posit infrastructure, for example, as an asset class that has enjoyed robust growth, but structurally is very heterogeneous, and there are challenges in forming a normalized view across that asset class. At the other end of the spectrum, I'd say private credit is intrinsically, more short dated and more liquid, and has more analytical tools available to it for investors to make sense of it. So I would say that there's some dispersion by asset class, probably even more so than by geography.
And as I mentioned, we'll dig into the details of some of those asset classes and different types of investors. But now that we have a sense of where we are, I'd love for you to walk us back, a little history lesson, if you will. How did we get here? And if I can focus a little bit, I'm very interested in the intersection between public and private markets and how they've evolved, either together or, a divergence between them.
Yeah, sure. I think it's a really interesting question, and I actually think it's quite foundational to thinking about the evolution of private markets from here, right? And so, look, at the end of the day, originally all markets were private, right? And I think that that's an interesting perspective, because I think there's a sense in which we say public markets are over here, private markets are here, private markets need to become public markets, and that's kind of their natural evolution. I'm not completely sure that that's the right mental model. Public markets as we know them today have been, you can pick a number, but I would say sort of 800 years plus in the making, right? The early bourses are, date from the sort of 13th century in Europe, and that's the original beginning of some sort of normalization, fungibility, shared investor pool around the formation of capital. And then you sort of see in the, I guess, sort of 17th and 18th century, Dutch East India and British, and these beginnings of what start to look like real corporations at scale, and that are attracting, arm's length capital, right? And I guess the definition, one definition of a public market is you have investors that don't know the principals, right? That's kind of a characteristic. And so you start to see, and you have the associated sort of manias and bubbles that come out of that, right? Which we still struggle with today in public markets. But because you have this remoteness between investors that can get excited about a story and then the actual people that are deploying the capital in the form of the corporation, there are all kinds of, unintended consequences you can get from that. And one of the things that I always like to highlight, because I think it shows how important this stuff is, the Mississippi bubble of the 1720s or wherever it was, which was quite a remarkable example of what looked like a sort of a public investment opportunity that ultimately was endorsed by the Crown of France, and the whole financial system of France almost oriented around providing capital into this investment, which ultimately ended up blowing up spectacularly. Really paved the way for ultimately the French Revolution, right? It led to such poor sort of financial conditions and such privation for the poor people that it ultimately, was one of the key catalysts for the French Revolution. So we've been playing around with public structures, for a long time, and they've been impacting, the course of politics for a long time. And so if you look at then, the evolution of modern markets over, call it the last 100 years, there's been a real, drive through regulation and just through market behavior to provide a higher degree of transparency and predictability so that people know, where their money is going. And it's still an imperfect system, but I think if you look today at where public markets are, they're characterized by huge amounts of information, very low latency between, events and the information being disseminated, an assumption of uniform access to information, right? So, insider trading or privileged information is really something that's frowned upon and that markets try to control. And so essentially what you're trying to provide is a level playing field for these remote investors to deploy capital with an expectation of outcomes, right? And then obviously very sophisticated, pricing and risk apparatus that's then been built on top of those structures, and that I would say characterizes today's public markets. And so if you look at the evolution of private markets, and again, you sort of go back to the dawn of time or the invention of credit, right? You're going back millennia to say, you know, when were people first staking other people with capital in order to do a venture? That's been going on for a very long time. But typically, you know, there's been these people have known each other, or there's been some degree of kind of connection and transparency where people are like, I'm investing in this venture or this person or this undertaking, I'm lending them money, they live next door to me, they live down the street. Like, you sort of know what you're getting into, and that's characterized private markets, and for the most part still does. You know, starting in, I guess, the sort of mid-20th century with the growth of venture and the sort of very early days of, you know, what became buyout, you start to see, you know, third-party intermediaries coming in and saying, you know, we're going to get to know these people that want to deploy capital, and really acting as an agent, we're then going to sort of syndicate out, you know, the opportunities for capital deployment to other investors that want to deploy. And the role of, you know, what became ultimately the general partner is really central to that intermediation, right? So you have a huge amount of information asymmetry. You have people that are spending your capital that you've never met and you never will meet in ways that, you know, you have no transparency into. But you're making significant investments. And so that process has been and largely continues to be intermediated by the role of the general partner that's responsible for prudent asset selection and management of that portfolio in order to generate a return for investors. We're still pretty much living in that world. I mean, I would say that the private market is maturing and evolving very rapidly. And I'd say the last, you know, 15 years or so has seen significant evolution. We've seen evolution in the shape of the fund structures. We've seen a lot of evolution in the transparency and reporting. We've seen the growth of secondary, you know, of more secondary markets for interest in the, you know, in these funds. But broadly speaking, we still have the general partners largely acting as the risk manager and arbiter of that capital.
No, thank you. That's very, very comprehensive history. And it sounds like it's very interesting when you talk about how private markets are actually older than public, but it sounds like as we've moved closer to today, is it fair to say they've started perhaps acting a little bit more like public markets, and that's led to their greater availability? Or am I oversimplifying that a bit?
I think there are a few different things going on. There's certainly been a decrease in the rate at which firms are accessing the public markets for equity. So we've seen, you know, in general, a prolonged slowdown in IPO volume and the use of IPO as a means to access capital. And as a result, we're seeing larger firms staying private for longer, or in some cases, almost indefinitely. And the late stage venture index that we launched at MSCI a couple of weeks back, I think is a very interesting example of that, where, you know, there are these almost household name private companies that are extremely profitable, extremely successful, you know, the SpaceX's and Stripes of the world, that are, you know, choosing not to go public, you know, in some cases for many years. And so that's a sort of a shift in funding allocation away from public markets to private markets. Now, I don't want to overplay that. The IPO window has been, you know, relatively closed for a while. Hopefully that reopens. I'm not sure that this is a, you know, it's not a binary trend, but it's certainly something that one can observe in terms of equity financing. And then I'd say, you know, by the same token, on the debt or the credit side, you know, there's been a sustained retrenchment in bank lending, and private markets have really stepped into and filled that gap. I think the other thing which is happening, which is really driving the maturation of this market and a lot of the evolution that we're seeing, is historically, I think private assets were treated as an interesting asset class, but that one that was held off a little bit to the side of the main investment book, right? So they were seen as being, you know, uncorrelated or less correlated than other assets, and they were seen as return as providing you know, outsized returns or alpha. And so when you and also just frankly a function largely of the smoothing reporting, but they had an attractive Sharpe ratio. They seemed like not very volatile. The marks kind of, you know, progressed in an orderly fashion. The returns were good, and therefore they looked like a nice investment class. And so starting, with 20 plus years ago, we started to see increasing allocations, you know, of public endowments, pensions, and asset management into this asset class, right? But still treated as a somewhat of a separate animal, sort of off to the side of the main public portfolio. I think one of the things that we're seeing is as privates as a proportion of the portfolio has grown, you know, pretty monotonically, and as sophistication of asset owners has grown generally, people are starting to revisit, I think, a little bit this assumption that privates just sit off to the side of the main portfolio, and they're starting to really think about, you know, what does a total portfolio approach look like across my portfolio? That doesn't necessarily mean that people are abandoning strategic asset allocation and rushing to a true total portfolio allocation strategy. I'm not necessarily saying that. But I do think that there is more of an expectation to be able to treat privates in some of the ways that they look at publics. So they want to have a better understanding, for example, of liquidity and cash characteristics, right? They want to understand the shapes of the J curve. What does it look like with drawdown? When do we expect to see capital returned? I think that's been, you know, really stressed over the last 3 or 4 years as we've seen distribution timelines really dilate in private equity, and people are not getting the cash returns that they expected, and they're starting to say, you know, gee, maybe this thing doesn't always perform, you know, the way it has historically. So I think liquidity and cash is an area of greater interest. And then also, I think going through, you know, some of the recent stresses that we've had on valuation, right? Some of the repricing that we saw in 22, for example, in private equity has led folks to think, you know, maybe these marks are not as kind of stable and monotonic as we thought they are. And we need to think about this a little bit more from a risk perspective. Sophisticated investors are saying it's not a reasonable assumption to say that this is not correlated. There's no overlap between these names, and there's not going to be, you know, contagion in the event of sort of credit events. And so we need to understand, you know, our genuine exposure in this book. And so I think those are, you know, some of the macro themes that are driving evolution of the asset class.
And you mentioned this term total portfolio approach, which has come up before in some of our discussions on this program. So getting into maybe what is a little bit of the micro of that, how can investors think about or go about the process of integrating privates into their total portfolio approach?
Full disclosure, I think that my team and MSCI more generally are very bullish on total portfolio as an organizing principle. I think that, you know, if I fast forward, you know, pick a number, 5 years in the industry, I would be amazed if we don't see much broader adoption of total portfolio techniques and management that include the private assets. So I think, you know, long term, I do think that this is kind of where we're going, at least directionally. I think there's a lot of work to be done in sort of, you know, uplifting the quality of the transparency and reporting that exists in private markets before that really becomes practical. So I think trying to pursue a total portfolio approach when you don't have the appropriate granularity, reporting, you know, factor analysis, et cetera, that you need on the private part of the portfolio, it is not really an intellectually honest exercise. And I think it's gonna, you know, maybe lead to a sense of sort of false security. You think you're looking at the total portfolio, but you're not really, because they're not really sort of fungible or comparable. So I think uplifting the quality of that data and that transparency in the private book is the sort of short-term priority. And so, you know, one of the things we're very focused on is, you know, across all of the sub-asset classes within privates, how do we help investors understand better the characteristics of those investments? And again, that can be from a cash and liquidity perspective. It can be from a credit exposure perspective. You know, the recent announcement we did with Moody's, I'm very excited about, in terms of bringing increased credit scoring and analytics to private credit, I think is a very constructive step in that direction.
And is that situation, as you mentioned, pretty generally across all the different sub-asset classes, or are there different issues with getting at the different risks and opportunities that might lie, say, in infrastructure or private credit, et cetera?
Yeah, I think it varies broadly. And in some cases, in many cases, it's sort of endemic to the nature of the asset class. And in some cases, I think it's arising from the evolution of the market structure. And what I mean by that is, if you look particularly at something like private credit, you know, the spectrum and the boundary between public and private credit is much more tenuous, right? And in some cases, some of the function, you know, some of the portfolios actually cross over, and we're seeing a lot of mixed public and private credit offerings, for example. So, you know, offerings from KKR and Apollo and others, where they really are creating a basket which is a hybrid of public and private credit and offering that to investors. And I think that, you know, Mark Rowan at Apollo has spoken, you know, quite extensively on this. And, you know, his view is really the delineation between public and private credit is somewhat artificial, and really one should just view it across the traditional dimensions that you would evaluate credit on. And this, whether it's public or private, is somewhat of an artificial distinction. You know, folks may or may not agree with that, you know, with that view, but there's no doubt that these firms are really driving transparency and liquidity into this market, much more so than has existed private, you know, previously. And I think this intersects with the growth of secondary markets more generally in private assets, and people have a desire to be able to trade in and out of positions in these funds, and that is already reshaping the duration and the nature of that. And then when you couple that with funds that are mixing highly liquid public credit with traditionally illiquid private credit, there's obviously kind of a gravitational pull, in my view, that's going to pull the private credit to look more like the public, and hence become, you know, more fungible, more comparable, and ultimately more tradable. You know, again, at the other end of the spectrum, you know, things like infrastructure projects, which are very heterogeneous, you know, very bespoke, very, very idiosyncratic, difficult to produce a normalized view across that entire portfolio. That doesn't mean that one can't make progress, and we aren't making progress in that. We actually spend a lot of time on doing that. We have a number of benchmarks that we provide to investors to help them understand the characteristics and performance of their infrastructure investments. But that's intrinsically a longer dated, slower moving, you know, part of the asset class that's not going to move as fast as private credit. So I think you will see a pretty broad dispersion across the asset class in terms of the rate at which it moves in this direction. But I also think, and this is something again that we at MSCI are working pretty diligently on, I think you'll see folks try to say, you know, what are basic building blocks of normalization that we can apply across all of the asset class. And so I think you'll see the floor, if you will, of comparability or normalization rising over time, but it'll be outstripped by those asset classes that are more liquid or faster moving, like private credit.
And what about on the people side, the client side? You talked a bit earlier, gave a very clear definition of the GP, the general partner. The counterpart of that is the LP, or limited partner. So for the benefit of our perspectives audience that does not have familiarity with these terms, can you start out by giving us a little definition of limited partners? But then I'm also curious, what are some of the trends that are driving the behaviors of both GPs and LPs right now?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the definition of limited partner flows naturally from the definition of general partner. So the general partner takes on the responsibility and operating role of essentially establishing the process by which capital is raised and deployed, the portfolio is managed and ultimately exited, and capital is returned successfully to those investors. And those investors come in the form of limited partners. And so those are participants in the structure that are not responsible for the day-to-day operation and deployment of capital, but rather depend on the general partner to do that on their behalf. So the function of the limited partner is to provide capital, you know, into that structure and into the fund, you know, ultimately for deployment, to enjoy, you know, the return of cash flow in due course, you know, consistent with that investment strategy, and to have certain information rights and transparency into how the general partner is deploying capital on their behalf. And so traditionally, limited partners have been, you know, large institutional investors, or in some cases, you know, large family offices or ultra high net worth individuals that have generally long duration capital that they can deploy into these enterprises over, you know, a 5 to 10 year time horizon, and have enjoyed, you know, outsized returns as a function of that investment strategy. And there are a variety of interesting debates as to why those returns are outsized. Is it a function of, you know, the holding period and the fact that it's patient capital? Is it a function of, you know, the general partner's excellence and insight in identifying, sourcing, underwriting, you know, the right opportunities? Is it a function of operational excellence on the general partner in terms of, you know, of helping and facilitating those companies to perform better? So that would be sort of managerial alpha, if you will. So there are a number of different, you know, theories for where this outsized performance comes from, but historically, the sort of pitch, if you will, of private assets has been, you know, you deploy, you know, substantial amount of capital for a substantial period of time, and you enjoy an outsized, you know, return as a function of that. Now, I think the definition, I think, is where your question is probably going. The definition of the limited partner is evolving, right? And so, you know, firms like iCapital, for example, have done, you know, a phenomenal job democratizing access to many of these to many of these vehicles, right? And they've created feeder funds and other structures that allow, you know, folks with not as much capital to deploy to still come in and get access to some of the world's top funds and enjoy those results. And increasingly, we're seeing you know, an interest in providing even broader access to the wealth market, and we're seeing the creation of new investment vehicles with the specific goal of expanding the definition of limited partner to include, you know, broader retail wealth.
And we'll get back to the wealth investors in a moment, but just sticking with the standard GPs and LPs and how their strategies and concerns are evolving. You mentioned at the top a bit about the current situation. And while we don't want to dwell too much on that, this is a longer term asset class for sure. Has there been any short-term adjustments, or are you hearing different types of concerns, let's say, over the last month or two from different clients?
You know, we're dealing with a range of outcomes, which is very broad, and hence the impact of that and the cascading effects of that are very hard to predict. And so they range between, you know, a quite dramatic reshaping of the global economy to, you know, more modest expectations that this is adjusted and sort of priced and we move forward. So there's really a broad, you know, dispersion of outcomes. I think what it means for us in private markets is a few things. Look, on the one hand, the economic uncertainty and risk off is always, you know, always slows down the pace in markets, right? So I think it makes it more difficult for folks to fundraise. It makes investors more hesitant to deploy capital. It makes people more likely to, you know, try to look for safe haven assets versus risk assets. So I think all of those are a headwind, albeit I don't think a long-term headwind, but certainly a short to medium-term headwind on, you know, just generally growth of the industry. But on a more positive note, I think it's actually a bit of a forcing function that may see us coming out quite a bit more mature on several dimensions in private assets over the next, you know, let's call it a year, right? And I think those dimensions are a fewfold. I think private credit, you know, risks being tested. You know, certainly many of the outcomes are, you know, recessionary or softening in nature, and those are going to test some of those private credits. And I think we've generally been in a fairly bull cycle from a private credit perspective. So I think that's going to be instructive. And test some of the risk management assumptions of private credit portfolios, which ultimately I think will strengthen the quality of the risk management. I think that delayed capital return, right? I don't think we're going to see a lot of IPO. I think there's going to be a dampening effect on M&A, and I think there's going to be a dampening effect on return of capital under these strategies. And so I think that is actually going to be a tailwind for the secondaries market. So I think we're going to see even more secondaries activity. And I think, again, secondaries is very interesting because ultimately it drives price formation and price discovery in these markets. And so in order to do price discovery at scale, you need a lot more data and you need it in a lot more real-time way. And so I think we're pretty excited actually about the way in which this might move the market forward from a liquidity and a transparency perspective. And I think last but not least, super interesting for a company like MSCI, people are taking much more of an overall factor exposure approach in these positions, right? And so as they start to reason about supply chain impact, disruption of supply chain, playing out various scenarios, I think a lot of the data that we're able to bring together, much of which we collect under the auspices of our sustainability data, but it really helps us understand supply chains, exposures, the way in which, you know, goods and capital flow in the global economy. And so being able to bring that information together around the total portfolio and try to reason around the behavior of that portfolio in these various scenarios, again, I think is really going to move people forward in the sophistication of some of that analysis.
So what about the wealth audience? How does their approach, not to the ultra present, but generally, when it comes to private assets, how does the approach of this slice of the market differ?
You know, people have historically wanted to participate in, you know, the creation of value in the economy, and investing is definitely one mechanism by which they do that. And so I think vehicles that allow, you know, a broader swath of investors to participate in where the value is being created in the economy are generally, you know, a good thing, and B, something that people are, you know, are excited about. So I think there's a natural, you know, sort of appetite for people to have broader exposure. I think people are interested in the return characteristics of the asset class. They're interested in the, again, perceived diversification and the outsized returns. I think that is where the rubber is going to start to meet the road a little bit. I think that there is just a level of transparency that is going to be required for financial advisors to feel comfortable putting their clients into these products at increased scale. I think they may well come to the conclusion that's a good decision, that this is an asset class that should be a larger proportion of investors' portfolios, especially depending where they are, you know, what stage in their sort of investment time horizon they are. But I think what we're already seeing, and we'll see more of, is a need for better transparency and comparability of these private assets with public assets. And again, this comes back to the total portfolio construction question of how do you put together a sensible portfolio that behaves in ways that you think it will. And I think in much the same way that the current market stress is pushing participants to evolve their thinking, I think it will definitely push us forward from a transparency and information perspective. I think that in general, we will just see more information being made available about these funds, about these investments that the wealth channel will demand. And I think that will be part of our journey towards providing, you know, a more comparable level of transparency that exists in public markets.
And last, but definitely not least, but last, because I'm being told we don't have much time left. If we're sitting here a year from now, 5 years from now, what are you hoping that conversation is like around private markets? What's exciting you?
So if I fast forward a year, I would hope that we're providing clients with even better analytics and risk tools and factor analysis on their private portfolios. I would hope that we're working with general partners to provide, you know, more information and transparency that investors are asking for, and that's enabling, you know, the growth of wealth and other investors that want to come into this asset class and the data that they need. And then if I think on a five-year time horizon, I would definitely hope that, the tools for total portfolio are available to those who need them, and they can really, you know, reason about the total portfolio in ways which right now, you know, people can't. So I think there's a lot of wood to chop, but I think we can make a huge amount of progress in the industry over the next several years.
Well, Luke, with that, thank you very much for coming on, sharing your insights. I know it's your first time on the program, but we hope it won't be your last.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's all for this week. We'll see you next time. Until then, I'm your host, Adam Bass, and this is MSCI Perspective.